It's 10:06. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. Kathleen will be back from her vacation next week. Well, music has been a part of human culture probably, well, I don't know, as far back as anyone can remember and probably well beyond that. There are a lot of really, really great stories in human history that center around the creation of or performance of a piece of music. Well, we're going to talk about a book that collected some of those stories. The book is titled The Greatest Music Stories Never Told, 100 Tales from Music History to Astonish, Bewilder, and Stupefy. We have the author of that work with us here today, Rick Beyer.
Hi, how you doing?
Good morning, and thanks for joining us. I appreciated this book. I discovered that I have something in common with Schubert. He owned two guitars, and so do I.
There you go, and so you should build on that connection. Maybe you'll find you have other things in common, and soon you'll be composing symphonies.
Well, he's dead, and I'm not, so there's a difference. But
right away, we run into a problem.
Yeah, and I doubt if I'm going to be composing any symphonies anytime soon. But this book is just loaded with fascinating stories, particularly for someone who is interested in the minutiae of history as I am, and as I'm sure a lot of our listeners are. Well, I kind of teased the audience with a quiz in the billboard to this program about 6 minutes ago, and so I'd better get some answers to some of the questions that I posed. And the listeners, be honest, when you grade your quizzes, if you got them wrong, you know, own up. So which ballet was it that sparked a riot?
Well, it's Stravinsky's Rite of Spring, and it was at its premiere in Paris in 1913, and this was a very new form of music and dance, and a lot of people reacted very poorly to it in the premiere of this ballet, and literally a riot broke out in the crowd, and you have this scene when you go back and you read the accounts of it. It's sort of beyond imagining, you know, jeweled socialites spitting in each other's faces, people throwing punches in the audience, because the audience is split between the people who are accepting and enthusiastic about this kind of new form of classical, what we would call classical music, and the people who think, wow, this new stuff is drivel, it's awful, it's, you know, atonic, it's you know, we can't stand it. And the hubbub in the audience, in fact, was so loud that the choreographer of the piece, who was the very famous dancer Nijinsky, had to call out the time to the dancers because they could not hear the orchestra playing because the riot was so spectacularly loud. So that's Rite of Spring, and I, you know, a number of other people didn't like it at the time, but since it's become an accepted and really cherished piece of music and of performance.
Okay, so the next question I asked in the introduction was, name the rock star who became an astrophysicist.
Well, that would be Brian May of Queen, the guitarist in Queen. He was actually studying astrophysics in school when the band took off, and so he took off from university and went, you know, on the touring rock star thing for 25 years. But then he went back, and I love this. He went back to school. He got a PhD. He wrote a thesis, and he became he wrote a book about the origins of the universe and became a chancellor, I think, of the John Moore University in Liverpool. And so, yes, he's probably the only astrophysicist in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Well, I was actually thinking of Brian.
That's for sure.
I was thinking of Brian Cox, who just wrote Wonders of the Universe and who I had on this program earlier this week.
Right,
who
also the punk music guy, right?
So, yeah, right, yeah.
This is like a growing trend, don't you think, which is rock and rollers named Brian becoming astrophysicists. I don't think Brian Wilson is going to fall into this trend, but I'm concerned about who else might.
But, you know, though, I have to say this, that the connection between music and science is mathematics.
Well, right. In fact, we credit Pythagoras with being and his followers were sort of coming up with some of the basic precepts of modern music and the relationships between the length of a string, and if you half the length of the string, you essentially double the note, et cetera, and all these relationships. And so it is mathematical, but I also thought it was interesting because Brian May said something that he said that, in fact, that the he thought that astrophysics was the opposite of music, he said, because instead of looking inwards, you know, you're looking outwards. So to him, music was kind of looking in and what you can do in your performance, and astrophysics was looking out at the universe and studying it there. So he saw the opposites there, where we're seeing the comparison.
The song that saved Wheaties.
The song that saved Wheaties is a jingle, and it's the very first radio jingle, and it was in the 1920s, in Christmas Eve of 1926, I think, is when it began in the nearby state of Minnesota on WCCO. They began running a 15-minute barbershop quartet that was called the Wheaties Quartet, and as part of their performance every Friday night or whenever they performed, they sang a song about Wheaties, which I will not sing for you, but which is a kind of a wonderful barbershop quartet tune about have you tried Wheaties and their whole wheat with all of the bran. Well, so anyway, but Wheaties was after a couple of years of this, Wheaties was doing really well in Minneapolis, but it was sinking like a stone in the rest of the country, and General Mills was going to dump the product. And the marketing guy got up and said, well, wait a minute, we're selling like two-thirds of what we're selling in the whole country. We're selling in Minneapolis because we're running this radio thing. Maybe we should try that in the rest of the country. So that local radio jingle in Minneapolis became a national radio jingle, and suddenly Wheaties became a huge best-selling cereal thanks to it.
Yeah, 830 WCCO, the good neighbor to the Northwest. A lot of us grew up listening to that station. The man killed by his own conducting. Now, that one, I thought, was one of the more bizarre stories in this book.
In a book of bizarre stories, that's one of the strangest. Jean-Baptiste Lully, I'm probably mispronouncing his name, but he was an Italian composer working in France in the late 1600s. And he, a lot of people consider him sort of the person who invented conducting because he was one of the first people to lead an orchestra and not play an instrument at the same time. And he led a big orchestra, and he did not have, this is prior to the baton becoming popular, so he did not use a baton, he used a giant staff, basically a big stick, which he's pounding on the ground, you know, this is maybe 4 or 5 feet long, pounding on the ground to keep time while he's conducting the orchestra. And in the midst of a piece that they're performing for the king, he pounds this thing onto his foot, ouch, really hard, and he causes like a real, you know, kind of it's a bone-crunching, skin-puncturing sort of wound to his foot. But, of course, keeps performing because, right, the show's the thing. And he refuses any medical attention, and then he kind of, until they're done, and then he really doesn't want much medical attention then either. Well, it ends up gangrene sets up in this thing, and it becomes infected, and he dies. So he is the only man killed by his own conducting.
And I never would have imagined that there could possibly have been any controversy behind Mary Had a Little Lamb until I looked at this book.
Well, Mary Had a Little Lamb is one of those songs we all know. And one of the things I do when I research one of the books in this series, because this is the fifth book in the series of greatest stories books, is I ask myself like questions that I would like to know the answer to, like where do popular things get started? And Mary Had a Little Lamb was very interesting because it had multiple stories of origin. And one involved a very famous woman in Boston, Sarah Joseph Hale, who was a great feminist, magazine editor, activist in the early to mid 1800s, and she is credited with writing Mary Had a Little Lamb. But there's an alternate version of the story that came out that a lot of people believe, because another woman came out, her name was Mary Sawyer, she came out years later and said, no, I was there, it was my lamb. It came to school one day, and there was a boy, a young man, in fact, who was like an apprentice teacher in the school, who was so charmed by the incident of the lamb following me to school that he wrote the first three verses of this song and gave them to me the next day. And so she claimed that that was the origin of the song and that the other version was essentially copied from that and expanded on it. And she, the thing about her story, you might say, okay, fine, well, maybe she's making this up. But she had all the names of the people, all the people that she talked about in the story were real, the teacher, the boy, everything. And other members of her family confirmed that it happened to her. So there are these sort of two alternate theories to how that song began, both happening in the Boston area, and people have been arguing about it ever since.
Amazing. Well, this book is full of stories. We can't tell all of them, but we do have some music to go with a few of them. And let's see. I want to go to the year is 1713, and the composer is Giuseppe Tartini. I want to have us listen to a piece, and then I want you to tell the story behind it. That's a short piece from is part of a longer work by Giuseppe Tartini. Now, what's the story behind this? It sounds sounds an awful lot like Vivaldi. I mean, that was the music of that age. It was Baroque.
Well, Tartini was an Italian composer, and one night he had a dream, and in his dream he dreamed that he had sold his soul to the devil, and the devil was attending every need that he had. So in the dream he offers the devil to his violin, to essentially say, well, here, you know, you're attending to my needs. I want to see what kind of music you can play. And the devil plays him music that is so singularly beautiful, he said, that he couldn't believe it. And he woke up from this dream, and he tried to write down the music that the devil had played for him. And he said he could only write down kind of a pale comparison to the music that he heard in his dream. But what he ended up writing became his violin sonata in G minor, which is known as the Devil's Trill. And I think it's probably the only piece of classical music that has a clear pedigree to being inspired by the devil, as opposed to being inspired by God. It kind of went in the other direction. And today it is regarded as really still one of the hardest pieces to play on violin. And it's the earliest example that I was able to find. I mean, this is almost 300 years ago, of this association between the devil and the violin that really has gone down through the years, through multiple different cultures and different types of music. I mean, there was another classical violinist, Paganini, who was accused of having sold his soul to the devil, and when he died, for years they wouldn't bury him in a churchyard because he was believed to have sold his soul. And then in sort of the Scotch-Irish culture and coming over to the Appalachian culture in America, there's a lot of associations between the devil and the violin, which the violin is sometimes called the devil's box in Appalachia. And there's all these fiddle tunes, the devil's dream, devil in the kitchen, devil in the woodpile. So there's this long association. And of course, in the famous Charlie Daniels song about the devil...
Devil went down to Georgia.
In the fiddle. So
yes.
But that was where it seems to have started some 300 years ago with that piece.
Well, and then from the violin, it jumped to the guitar. Robert Johnson was accused of having sold his soul to the devil so that he could play that instrument.
Well, not accused of it. He said that that's what happened, that in fact he'd sold his soul to the devil at a crossroads. Which is interesting, you know, and I wanted to have a Robert Johnson story in this book because I think he's a really interesting character, but one of the troublesome things from a historian's point of view is that just about everything you can find out about Robert Johnson is so layered in myth and alternate versions and kind of hazy origins, it's really difficult to pin anything down there. And I was trying very hard to make sure that the stories that did get into the book, out of the so many that you could find and try to put in, you know, were stuff that I could really verify and were absolutely true.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. Before we do that, though, I want to invite listeners to call in with their comments or questions on what they've heard. They might have questions that aren't necessarily in the book, but I would be willing to bet that Rick Beyer can answer them if it's about music history, because, as you said, this was the fifth in this series, The Greatest Music Stories Never Told, a fascinating work that I've had the good fortune to be able to read. Here's the number to call to join the program, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email address talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. You can also go to Facebook. There's a Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. Leave a comment there. So, three ways to interact with the program. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Almost 23 minutes after 10 o'clock, you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's what's coming up later on today on the Ideas Network. After 3 on Here on Earth, Radio Without Borders, Jean Faraca and her guests discuss the reasons for the low percentage of girls born in Asia. That's coming up after 3 o'clock this afternoon here on the Ideas Network. This hour, we're talking about the book, The Greatest Music Stories Never Told. My guest is the author, Rick Beyer. He's a successful author, an award-winning documentary producer, and an accomplished professional speaker. His other books in the series include The Greatest Stories Never Told, The Greatest War Stories Never Told, The Greatest Presidential Stories Never Told, and The Greatest Science Stories Never Told. So this hour we're talking about music. And, you know, I missed a great opportunity at the break. I could have said, we'll be right, Bach, but I
That's almost as bad as some of the puns that I like to use. But so we're so glad that you didn't do that, and I applaud you on your restraint.
I could have said when you're out of Bach, you're Baroque, but I'll skip that as well. Anyway,
back to the future. Okay.
Yeah, I did a show on puns a few months ago. I don't want to go back there. But speaking of Bach, there's a story in your book about Bach and coffee, and I have a piece of Bach to go with it.
Hat man nicht mit seinen Kindern hunderttausend Hudelei, hat man nicht mit seinen Kindern.
Now, the German's a little thick there, but Bach liked his coffee.
Bach liked his coffee, and of all, you know, we consider Bach such a serious and religious composer, and this is a piece, the Coffee Cantata, that is as anything but. Basically, back in the day here being the 1730s, Bach and a bunch of musicians got together, coffee house, right, for a Friday night gig at Zimmerman's Coffee House in Leipzig. And coffee was kind of controversial at that time. I like to quote from this women's petition against coffee from about 40 or 50 years earlier that describes it as base, black, thick, nasty, bitter, stinking, nauseous puddle water. There were a lot of people who didn't like coffee, and politically there were people who didn't like coffee because coffee was thought to sort of stimulate political unrest. And so Bach wrote this piece, the Coffee Cantata, sort of as a way of poking fun at the people who were trying to ban coffee or put down coffee, and also kind of a little bit as an advertisement for Zimmerman's Coffee House. And one of the characters in this piece, the main character, is a young woman whose father is trying to convince her to give up coffee, and she refuses his entreaties with these words, and I think that any modern-day coffee addict would share the sentiment: if I can't drink my bowl of coffee three times daily, then in my torment I will shrivel up like a piece of roast goat. I don't know how many times I've said that. But or at least I've felt it if I haven't said it every time. But so Bach was a little bit of a coffee addict and also kind of a little bit of a coffee promoter there, one of the little known sides of his career.
Well, I have to confess, I laughed out loud when I read the words in the proclamation issued by King Frederick the Great of Prussia against coffee. He said, "It is disgusting to notice the increase in the quantity of coffee used by my subjects and the amount of money that goes out of the country in consequence. Everybody is using coffee. If possible, this must be prevented. My people must drink beer."
Yes, admonishing his people to drink beer and saying, by the way, he goes on to say that people who drink coffee don't make good soldiers. The good soldiers are all the beer drinkers.
Yes, his soldiers drink beer, yes.
Yeah, so luckily his anti-coffee rantings only lasted as long as he lived. He put all these anti-coffee rules into effect, and when he died, they were all taken out of effect. So they only lasted during his lifetime.
Well, if we went through all the different things that were proscribed during the life of Bach, I think that one time in northern Germany, instruments were prohibited from churches, and that accounts for some of the a cappella pieces that Bach wrote.
Well, yeah, right. And, you know, anytime you prohibit different things, it leads to that can be a catalyst for invention and inspiration. I thought it was interesting to note also a little later on, Ben Franklin invents an instrument called the harmonica, or sometimes called the glass harmonica, which mimics the sound that you make when you wet your finger and roll it around on the rim of a wine glass. And it's an incredibly popular instrument for a while. And then people start to believe that it can drive listeners insane, and in fact, Germany is one of the places that it was very popular. There were factories making the instrument there, and then in the early 1800s, it is banned. It is banned from being made. It is banned from being played because of its supposed deadly powers.
Wow. There is a huge New Year's Eve tradition, which is as the clock strikes midnight, we celebrate by singing a song that most of us completely mispronounce and have no idea what the meaning is, but it sounds something like this.
For auld lang syne, my Jo, for auld lang syne, we'll tak a cup o' kindness yet, for auld lang syne, and share. And surely I'll be mine, and we'll take a cup of kindness yet for auld lang syne.
This became a tradition, and it was the poet Robert Burns, was it not, who gave us this song?
Well, it's the poet Robert Burns who found the song. That's the interesting thing. He's often credited as being its composer. He says no. He says that he was walking down the street one day and he heard an old man sing a little bit of a song that he'd never heard before, a glorious fragment, he called it, written by a heaven-inspired poet. So he scribbled down those words, then added some verses of his own, and then put the whole thing to a traditional Scottish folk song. Burns being a great collector back then in the late 1700s of even older Scottish folk songs. And it goes on, really, I think it was either published right before he died or published after his death, but it goes on to become, of course, his most well-known work, even though he said he didn't write it, that he only just found it. And what I thought was interesting, of course, it's been associated with New Year's for a very long time in this country, back to the 1890s and even earlier in Scotland. But it's also played at all sorts of other different kinds of celebrations and ceremonies in various parts of the world. It's frequently played at funerals and graduations in Taiwan. I think, why would you have the same song for those two events? I'm not sure. In Thailand, people sing it after sporting matches, and in some Japanese department stores, they play it at the end of the day to say that that the store is closing now. So it really is a song with an international flavor. I mean, it's known all over the world, and it is, you know, one wants to say, if this old man was singing this fragment of it on the road one day, well, where did he get it from? You know, where did that come from? And there are other, you know, people have gone back into the archives and researched, and they have found very, very old poems in Scotland with the phrase, should old acquaintance be forgot, and Auld Lang Syne, dating back to the 1600s. So I think we have to give Robert Burns the credit for kind of putting it together, but it has origins that definitely predate him.
The program today is about the book, The Greatest Music Stories Never Told. I have its author, Rick Beyer, with me on the phone, and you can be too at 800-486-8655. We have a call from Marty in Sister Bay. Marty, good morning.
Hi, good morning. Rick, I'm wondering if you, I haven't seen the book yet, but I'm wondering if you had a section on Richard Wagner. I know, you probably know, he wrote all these monumental operas, and he was a socialist revolutionary, was involved in some sort of uprising in Dresden, and was married but had affairs, but he liked to wear silk underwear and imported French perfumes for his personal use, which was pretty interesting. Do you have anything in the book about that?
I sadly don't have anything about Wagner in the book, and, you know, it's always challenging if you're trying to write 100 stories, which end up covering, I guess in this case, about 3,500 years of history, I guess you're going to leave a few things out. And he is a fascinating character also, of course, politically, sort of an inspiration for some of the Nazi Party people who came later, and there's some interesting overlaps there. But I did not put anything in the book about Wagner. Sorry about that.
Thanks for the call, Marty. Let's go to Judy in Oconto. Judy, good morning.
Good morning. Regarding the song Mary Had a Little Lamb, there's a plaque on the road between Newport, New Hampshire and Sunapee, New Hampshire, where they claim the woman who wrote the song lived. I wish I had remembered more detail or taken the time when we went past it a few weeks ago. But for many, many years, that area, Newport, New Hampshire, has claimed to be the origin of the song.
Well, right. That's where Sarah Josepha Hale was living at the time when her book, Poems for Our Children, came out in 1830. And she later moved to Boston and became a big magazine editor there. So that's why they claim it. But then the town of Sterling, Massachusetts, also claims it because this other woman, Mary Sawyer, lived there, and that's where she says it happened and that she was involved in it. And interestingly enough, one of the people who really believed Mary Sawyer's version of the story was Henry Ford. And he purchased the schoolhouse where this in Sterling, Mass., where this supposedly happened, and he moved it to what was at that time a property he owned in Sudbury, Massachusetts, near where the Wayfarer Inn is now. And it's still there. So you can go and I went there and peered in the window one day. I didn't go when it was open and give a tour. But so, you know, I guess in matters like this, you sort of pay your money and you take your chances as to which story of origin you're more likely to believe. I have another story in the book about Jingle Bells, and there are two cities that argue over which one is the place of origin of Jingle Bells, and one is Medford, Massachusetts, and the other is Savannah, Georgia. Now, there's no argument about who wrote Jingle Bells. It's a man named James Pierpont, I think, James Lloyd Pierpont. I should quick look it up to make sure I have his name right. But the question is, he was originally from Medford, but then he became choir director at a church in Savannah, and both cities have plaques up saying that's the place where Jingle Bells was written. So lots of arguments about some of those things.
Hard to think of a song that's more associated with winter other than White Christmas, but being written where they rarely get, if ever, get snow.
Yes, well, right, but maybe he was writing it in Savannah, thinking of the days when he lived back in Medford, James Lloyd Pierpont. I just wanted to double-check that and make sure I was getting his name right. And what I always think is interesting is we think of Jingle Bells sometimes as a Christmas song. I always want to say, listen to the lyrics, because this is a song about driving, you know, fast sleds and picking up girls. It really has nothing to do with Christmas at all. It's kind of like a Beach Boys song.
Well, it's a winter song.
Pardon?
It's a winter song.
It's a winter song, right. And it's a winter song about sort of young people doing fun things. And so it had really nothing to do with Christmas at all. I have a quiz for you. Of course, you may know the answer, because if you carefully read the book, you will. But so should we call Dixie a song of the North or a song of the South?
Well, you know, that was very prescient of you, because that's where I was going next, and I think I have this queued up.
I was in the land of cotton, old times are I'm not forgotten. Look away, look away, look away, Dixieland, in Dixieland.
Now, we know Dixieland is the anthem of the South, and so the assumption would be, of course, it's a Southern song, but I'm guessing since you asked the question, it's probably not.
Well, just like Jingle Bells might have been written in Savannah, Georgia, I can say with some authority that Dixie was written by an Ohio man in a New York hotel room. And his name was Daniel Decatur Emmett. And he wrote the song basically as a show tune. It was for a minstrel show. These were very popular at the time, where white performers in blackface sang songs that they essentially that were imagined to be what slaves were singing on the plantation. And so he wrote the song Dixie for that, and the year was 1859. And, of course, 2 years later, the Civil War breaks out, and Dixie becomes the anthem of the South. And two interesting points there. One is it was a new song. I mean, this wasn't some old traditional song that people had been singing for years. It's like somebody now, if there was a revolution or a Civil War and somebody adopts a Justin Bieber song or something else that's, you know, on the charts from the last 2 years. And the other thing is that Emmett was incensed that the South had taken his song and adopted it as their anthem. He said, if I'd known they were going to put my song to that use, I'd be damned if I'd have written it. So in my world of punning and humor, I guess he's the original damned Yankee.
Well, there have been a number of controversies like that in recent election campaigns, where certain candidates have tried to adopt a song as their campaign theme, and the original writers of the song, not liking the candidate, have said, "Knock it off! I don't want my song associated with your campaign."
Exactly, but it's a lot harder to go to court when it's an army fighting a war against your country. They're not so likely to listen to some Supreme Court ruling or judge's ruling that says that they can't do that.
Your conclusion to that story was kind of interesting, involving Lincoln and what happened just after Lee's surrender at Appomattox.
Right. Well, Lincoln liked Dixie. And the day after Lee surrendered at Appomattox, Lincoln was speaking from a balcony at the White House, and he asked the band to strike up the song Dixie. And he said, "I've always thought Dixie was one of the best tunes I ever heard. Our adversaries over the way attempted to appropriate it, but we have fairly captured it." And so that was really only a few days before he was assassinated. But he was sort of trying to bind the country there together, back together again, and using Dixie as a way to do that.
We had a caller who couldn't stay with us who wanted to make a comment on you had talked about Ben Franklin inventing the harmonica. And this caller was saying that people who played this instrument went crazy because they got lead poisoning from it.
Well, that was an assumption that was made, because glass contained lead, and your hands, the way the instrument is set up, let me back up and say, the way the instrument is set up is there's a series of glass bowls on a spindle, on a horizontal spindle, and the bottom of them dips into the water, so you don't have to keep licking your fingers as you're doing this, and you do a foot pedal that rotates the spindle, it spins these bowls, and then you rub your fingers on them as they're spinning, and that's what makes the sound. So people said, oh, well, the reason that it drove people insane is because there was lead in the bowls. But there's plenty of people who played this instrument, including Franklin himself, who lived to a very old age and had no such problems at all. So it seems likely that that probably is something that was sort of superimposed as a later explanation and isn't necessarily a reality from the time. I think it's more likely the instrument was used by a very controversial Viennese doctor named Anton Mesmer, and that's where we get the word mesmerizing from. In fact, Mozart first heard this instrument in Mesmer's parlor at a party at Mesmer's house, and Mozart later wrote a piece for it. And Mesmer used it as part of his, essentially he was trying to induce hypnosis. Hypnosis hadn't been invented yet, but he was trying to hypnotize patients and sort of put them in a different mind state, and he used the instrument for that purpose. And he became discredited, and his ideas became discredited, and he was viewed very controversially. And I think that the instrument kind of fell into disfavor, and stories started being told about it, in large part because of its connection with Mesmer rather than the lead poisoning idea.
Hmm. Well, a similar claim, according to my producers, in the insanity part, has been made about oboe players because the double reed is so narrow that enormous amounts of pressure build up in the player's head. Now, I've known a number of oboe players, and they all seemed normal to me.
Yes, I did not know that story and don't know any oboe players, so I'm afraid that I'm going to be low on the information highway on this one.
Okay, well, let's move on. Coming over,
I know some drummers who have some real issues, but we don't want to go there.
Yeah, well, drummers. If we're going to start talking about drummers, that would be an entire hour on its own. Let's see here. I think I need to take a break at some point. Let me just do one more thing, and then we will do that. America's first recording star was an African-American street musician who started cutting records just 25 years after the end of the Civil War, and here's what he sounded like. Now, that was George Washington Johnson, and he was a famous recording artist of his day, but the reason he was famous wasn't for his singing.
Well,
he had another skill.
He was a street musician, and he was a very good whistler. And in the early days of recording, you know, some of the lyrics weren't coming through particularly clearly because the recording is all mechanical. It's non-electronic. You're essentially singing or shouting into this horn, and it's got to go down and make the through the stylus and make grooves in a. It's not even a disc at that point. It's a cylinder. And so they found that a lot of the lyrics didn't come through so clearly, but instrumental music or whistling came through very clearly. And so George Washington Johnson found himself on the cusp of this new industry, and he had been an itinerant street musician, and suddenly he starts to become a recording star. And, you know, in those days, by the way, you could only make about 5 copies of a record at once because you literally had to sing into 5, you know, recording Victrolas there at a time and do this over and over and over again. So you might sing the song or whistle the song 50 times in a day in order to get 250 copies. But going through that process, he managed in the 1890s to probably make somewhere around 50,000 recordings. So pretty incredible. He was also essentially a real leather-lunged guy. You know, he could do it over and over and over again. And he did it. He also had a trick that he did laughing. He would laugh in tune to music. And I have to say, it's fair to point out here that the songs that he recorded, if we should list the names of those songs, they are stuff that we would regard today as very racist and very offensive. He had a song called "The Whistling Coon." That was one of his biggest hit songs. And so it's a kind of a two-sided story. It's an African American who has a lot of success and some celebrity back in the 1890s and the early days of music recording, but it's also a story of sort of the ingrained racism that's still there, and it's only by kind of partaking in that he has that success 25 years after the Civil War.
We're going to we'll take a break, and we'll be back on the flip side of that break hear more from Rick Beyer about the greatest music stories never told. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 10:47. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. Larry Mueller is in after 11 o'clock with the Wisconsin Secretary of Tourism, who joins him. They'll talk about their favorite Wisconsin destinations and upcoming festivals and events. Stephanie Klett, Secretary of the Department of Tourism, will be Larry's guest after 11 today. This hour, it's music And we're talking about the book, The Greatest Music Stories Never Told, 100 Tales from Music History to Astonish, Bewilder, and Stupefy. Rick Beyer is the author of that and a number of other books on a similar theme, not having to do with music, but untold stories. And we're kind of working our way through some of these. We're not going to tell you all of them because, well,
then you wouldn't buy the book.
You wouldn't buy the book. This ain't my first rodeo. There's some other stories I want to get to. We've only got about 10 minutes left here. There was a hit song born in a history class. What was that about?
Well, it was back in the 1930s, and this history teacher in the small town of Snowball, Arkansas, wanted to try to teach his students about the War of 1812, and I didn't really know. They couldn't tell the difference. He found that the kids in this junior high school class couldn't really tell the difference between the War of 1812 and the Revolutionary War, and they didn't seem to understand the difference or care about it. So he decided, he was a songwriter in his part time. His name was James Morris, and he decided to write a song that helped understand a key battle of the War of 1812, and that song was called The Battle of New Orleans. And so he plays it for his class and plays it for successive classes. And now some time passes, and it's about 20 years later, and he's the principal of the high school, and he's still teaching the class. And a music store owner hears him sing this song and says, well, you know, you ought to send that to a publisher in Nashville. Well, the next thing you know, James Morris, he's 50 years old, he has a new career. He changes his name to Jimmy Driftwood, and he becomes a singer-songwriter. And that song, The Battle of New Orleans, he records it, but a guy named Johnny Horton records it as well, and suddenly in 1960, it shoots up to number one, it wins a Grammy, it becomes a huge hit song, and probably the only one born in a history class.
Wow, yeah, I remember Johnny Horton and that song.
Well, and you know, one of my favorite, a lot of people have recorded this song, and one of the versions that I haven't heard, but I just sort of like to imagine, is the Mormon Tabernacle Choir version of the Battle of New Orleans. I would think somehow that that would be something to actually hear that.
Yes, it would. Wow.
I can't quite get my hands or arms around what it would sound like, but I bet it sounds good.
No, I can't either. There was another song that came from a mayoral campaign.
And I live in Lexington, Mass., and this song actually outside of Boston, and this song came out of a 1949 mayoral campaign in Boston. And there was a big issue involving our public transportation system, because what happened is the city of Boston, it had been a privately owned elevated railway and subway, and the city of Boston bought it. And then they turned around and they raised the fares in order to pay for having bought it. And a lot of people consider this to be kind of a corporate bailout. Oh, you're raising our fares so you can give a lot of money to the private company that you bought this transit system from. And one of the people who was really unhappy about this was a mayoral candidate named Walter O'Brien. And so he was kind of a left-wing fringe candidate. He wasn't one of the main candidates. He didn't win. But he had some people working for him who were writing songs to try to promote his candidacy, and they wrote a song called Charlie on the MTA. And actually, that wasn't what they were originally going to call it. They were going to call it Agnes on the MTA. It was their main character, and the song was named Agnes. I don't know, like the Scottish, you know, male version. I don't know where they got that from, but they decided at the last minute to change it to Charlie. And so that song was played in sound trucks in that campaign. About 10 years later, the Kingston Trio recorded it, and of course that's when it became a huge hit. They changed the name of the mayoral candidate in the song to avoid being associated with this guy who'd been accused of being a socialist and all sorts of other things, from Walter O'Brien to George O'Brien. But of course that's where it began. And the tune, by the way, is much, much older. The tune, that song was, they wrote lyrics to it, but the original tune comes from a song in the 1800s, from 1865, by Henry Clay Work, called The Ship That Never Returned. So like so many things in music, you know, it some of it's new, but some of it is built on all these other things that people did before.
Yeah, I'll never forget that lyric. Now, you citizens of Boston, don't you think it's a scandal how the people have to pay and pay? There we go.
Yeah, fight the fare increase, vote for George O'Brien, get poor Charlie off the MTA. And interestingly, the guy who was the lead singer on the very initial version of this song, the one that they played from the sound trucks for the 1949 campaign. His name is Sam Berman, and he lives in my town, which is Lexington, Mass. He's still alive, and he can still sing that song.
Huh. Wow. Okay, who helped make For He's a Jolly Good Fellow world famous?
Well, that would be Marie Antoinette. Well, I'm sure you knew the answer before you asked the question. I think this was among the stories that I found. This was, to me, one of the most surprising. Marie Antoinette was Queen of France, and we remember her chiefly because of the day she lost her head. But sometime before that, she had a baby. And, of course, since she's Queen of France, she gives the baby over to a nurse, and the nurse begins to sing to the baby this obscure French country melody that hardly anybody knew. It's a little kind of old folk song called Marlboro Goes Off to the War. That would be the English translation. It was kind of a little ditty making fun of an English general, the Duke of Marlborough. And so she's singing this song to the baby. Well, Marie Antoinette hears the song, and she starts singing it. The king hears it. He starts singing it. Soon the whole court starts singing it. Soon all of Paris is singing it. People, visitors to Paris in this period, got irritated at the fact that you couldn't avoid this song. Everybody was singing it all the time. Eventually it crosses the channel to England, where somebody writes a new set of lyrics to it in English. We don't know who that person is, and that's For He's a Jolly Good Fellow. And so we would probably never know this song. It never would have kind of been rediscovered from obscurity and new lyrics written to it if it hadn't been for Marie Antoinette. So we can, next time you sing it, you can think For He's a Jolly Good Fellow. Instead of singing As Nobody Can Deny, we can say, Thank you, Marie Antoinette.
And let them eat cake or something.
Yes, and let them eat cake.
I did not want to let the hour go by without having you tell the story of the FBI investigation of this popular song. Anybody listening who does not know that song, well, I don't know where you've been for the last 60 years, but Louie, the Kingsman, that sparked an FBI investigation. What was going on there?
The FBI conducted a 30-month investigation, almost 3 years, to try to figure out what the lyrics were of that song. Okay, I kid you not. What happened is that they got complaints that the song was filled with dirty words. And the governor of Indiana proclaimed the song was pornographic, and then prosecutors got into the act, and they called in the FBI. So the FBI, you know, of course, the lyrics, as written down, weren't dirty. But they were assumed that maybe they were secretly singing something else, and they called in the singer, they called in the songwriter, they threatened people with jail, they collected various sets of alternative lyrics, and they sent the song to their crime lab, and the crime lab would speed the record up and slow it down, and then they reported that none of the speeds assisted in determining the words, which I think led to the saying that Louie Louie was unintelligible at any speed. But the result of all this, of course, predictably, is that a song that might have been mildly popular otherwise became hugely popular because everybody else, all the kids in school, are trying to figure out what the dirty words are. They must be there. The FBI is looking into it. And so Louie becomes a rock and roll legend. Although, it was worth pointing out, it never got to number one on the charts because it was denied that by the number one song, the singing nun singing her song, Dominica. So I don't know what that says, that the song with dirty words didn't get to number one because of the song by the singing nun, but we'll probably have to leave that for another day.
And we only have about a minute left, but I wanted to finish with this, the story of the song City of New Orleans.
Oh, it's a great song. Arlo Guthrie is performing in a bar in Chicago one night, and after he's done, the owner of the bar says, oh, there's a young guy here who'd like to play you a song. And Arlo Guthrie's like, oh, no, I don't want some young guy playing me a song and some terrible song, and then he'll be asking me what I think. But he looks over, he says, well, it's a nice-looking kid. So he said, kid, I'll tell you what. He said, you can buy me a beer, And if you buy me a beer, I'll drink that beer. And while I'm drinking that beer, you can do whatever you want. And so this very young songwriter, whose name was Steve Goodman, buys him a beer, and then he plays Arlo Guthrie this song, which is The City of New Orleans. Johnny Cash has called it the best damn train song of all time. It was a big hit for Arlo Guthrie. And I love Guthrie's comment upon hearing this. He says, "That was one of the finer beers I ever had."
Yeah, I think I've heard Arlo Guthrie tell that story, too, and it's a good one. Well, thank you. A lot of great stories in this extremely entertaining book. Thank you so much for joining me today, and thanks for sharing the book with us.
My great pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
The Greatest Music Stories Never Told, 100 Tales from Music History to Astonish, Bewilder, and Stupefy, written by Rick Baker. Rhonda Fanning produced this hour of programming. Chrissy Pease handled on-air production. Kathleen Dunn will be back next week. Enjoyed these 2 weeks with you. Thanks for listening and for calling in. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
How are you? Don't you know me? I'm your native son. I'm the train they call the City of New Orleans. I'll be gone 500 miles when the day is done.
This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.